Welcome again, everyone. So we're going to start off, I thought, with a little bit of a talk. And then afterwards, you have a chance for some questions, if you like. And then we can see how things go from there. The topic is about right view. And I was talked specifically to talk about right view in one's professional life, perhaps. But really, the reality is that the idea of right view is something you take across all aspects of your life, whether it's your private life, your professional life, or of course your spiritual life. Everywhere you need this idea of right view. It has to be integrated into all aspects of your life, and that's when it starts to have a certain power. Now, traditionally in Buddhism, when we talk about right view, we talk about things like having a degree of confidence in rebirth, the laws of karma. Yeah, these sort of things, the Four Noble Truths is an aspect of right view. So these are important, very important aspects of right view. There's only one problem with them. And the problem with these aspects of right view is that they tend to be a little bit theoretical and hard to take on board and really comprehend what they mean. You ask a Buddhist and you ask them, have you got right view? They say, I believe in rebirth. And they walk off and that's it. That's too shallow. It's not enough. Yeah, if you say that, you know they haven't really gone in. It hasn't really sunk inside what the meaning of this is, the consequences of these particular things that we have right view about. Right view is not a superficial thing. It's not something that you either have it or you don't. It's not a binary one or a zero. That's not how right view works. The idea of right view is to reflect on these things that the Buddha says is a reality, and then ask ourselves, what are the consequences of these things? How do they affect our life? How do they change our outlook? How do they make us behave in a different way in this world? This is the significance of right view. And this is what I want to talk about a little bit this afternoon. One of these aspects of right view is the idea of non-self. And I'm going to start off talking a little bit about non-self, and I will show you how the idea of non-self actually can be used in our ordinary life to actually change our perception of the world and change the way we relate to people and the way we deal with our professional life or whatever it is. And sometimes the idea of non-self seems like a very theoretical thing. Yeah, there is no self there. And you have these kind of suttas where the Buddha explains what is non-self. And you read it and you think, yeah, okay, maybe true, but you know, it's hard to relate to sometimes. You know what I mean? I don't know if you maybe you know what I mean. But how can we use this in a practical way? All of these things have a practical aspect to them. And one of the things I get invited to pretty much every year or the last few years, which is kind of interesting, and I do these things because they provide an additional challenge sometimes to my monastic life. And I've been invited to give a human rights talk at one of the big universities in Perth called Curtin University. And I go there every year. There's a graduate class, yeah, like a master's class or something like that. And they need lecturers on human rights. And they actually invite people from different religions. We are called a religion. I don't like that. But anyway, I say, okay, I'm a religion for this purpose, so you can take me in. So they invite us in, and they hear about human rights. So I always had to think, well, what is the Buddhist kind of idea of human rights? Now, one of the foundations of human rights, if you read the United Nations Charter of Human Rights, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, or whatever it's called, it says that all beings, not all beings, that's a Buddhist thing, all humans are born equal in, what is it, equal in dignity and rights, I think, something like that. All humans are born equal in dignity and rights. Now that already is problematic from an ordinary secular point of view. Because why are all people equal? Can we justify that from some kind of philosophical principle that all people are equal? It's not easy. Why, if you look around the world, people don't seem to be equal. Some people are born rich, some are born poor, some are born intelligent, some are born not so intelligent. I was going to use another word, but I don't want to use that other word. Best to use less intelligent. Some are born with illnesses. Some are born healthy. Some are born in war zones. Some are born in prosperity. It seems incredibly unequal. How can we find some foundation and basis for the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights that actually makes it plausible that human beings actually are equal? And I think that we have that in Buddhism. And that is why I wanted to, when I went there to this human rights lecture, I talked about the Buddhist approach to this. And to them, it was an eye-opener because they had never really heard such an approach to these particular dilemmas before. And what I told them is that in Buddhism, we have this idea of non-self. And as you may know, the idea of non-self, not being conceited, there's three types of conceit in Buddhism. Superior conceit, adimana, in Pali, equality conceit, and then inferiority conceit. You either consider yourself better or worse or equal to other people. And all of those are wrong according to Buddhism. They're all wrong. Why? Because they are based on this idea inside of us, of this sense of self. And if you look at people in the world from a Buddhist point of view, you can see how this works out, because we are always changing. We're always moving from one state to another one, from one position in life to another one. Sometimes you invest all your money on the wrong shares on the stock market, and the next day you jump off a tall building. Have you seen that? It's tragic, isn't it? It's silly. People actually identify so much with their wealth because they go bankrupt and then they jump off a tall building. All of these things change. These days people are getting sex change. They start off as a man, then become a woman. This is happening more and more these days. Or people do all kind of things. We change from being healthy, of course, to being ill. We change from being young to being older. And we change our stations in life so much. And of course, from a Buddhist point of view, so there's enormous flexibility there. And this is the root cause for why we cannot really compare ourselves to others, because there is no essence inside of us that stays stable. And I can say, this is me, this is you, and this is what we can compare. There is no baseline that we can compare each other with. We're always changing. And if you're always changing, which you are you going to compare with this other person? One day you are here and you move around and then you're equal and then things go like this, it's too flexible. There's nothing there to be compared. And if you look across lifetimes, this becomes even more powerful. This is where the Buddhist idea of rebirth comes in. Because if you look across lifetimes, one life you are a man, next life you are a woman. Past life you were a woman or you were a man. One life you're born in Sri Lanka, another life you're born in Norway. I happen to be born in Norway, or Sri Lanka, or Denmark, or I don't know, wherever else people are from. One life you are born into one social position, another position. One life you're handicapped, another life you are healthy. We're always changing, always moving around, especially when you look across lifetimes. That makes it even more powerful. One life you might be an animal. Hopefully not too often, but this is what happens, especially mosquito. That would be terrible to be reborn as a mosquito. Everybody wants to kill you all the time. That's, dukkha. So we move around so much. How can we compare each other? There's no essence. There is no baseline we can compare. We are this fluctuating phenomena. Do you feel like a fluctuating phenomenon? We are fluctuating phenomena, always moving, always changing, going from one thing to another one. We cannot compare. And that is why we have this idea in Buddhism about the equality conceit. Why? Because if you are equal, it means somehow you can compare, but you can't. And it's a very beautiful thing, because when I think of myself, sometimes I ask myself why it is that I'm a Buddhist monk. And of course, when people ask me that question, what I would like to say is that it's because I'm incredibly smart. Because I looked at all the philosophies and I figured, these are all nonsense. I chose the right philosophy. So I'm really, because I'm really intelligent, I'm a very clever kind of person. That's why I chose Buddhism. But to be honest with you, that probably is not true. The truth is probably, the reason I'm a Buddhist monk is probably because I was a Buddhist monk in a past life. It's a continuation of a habit. It happens to be a very good habit. I have to admit, it's a really good habit to be a Buddhist monk. It's a good habit, but still, it's a habit. It's just something that kind of crosses over from one life to the next one. And if I was a Buddhist monk, it probably wasn't in Europe, because there were no Buddhist monks in Europe, if it was a previous life. Quite likely, it was here in Sri Lanka. I like Sri Lankan food. Yeah, I like Sri Lankan people. I like the kind of the island of Sri Lanka. So probably I was a Sri Lankan nun, maybe, or a monk in a past life. And there's something beautiful about that. When we start to realize that we are not who we seem to be on the surface, actually inside of us, much deeper inside, we are all of these things. Yeah, all of these things exist inside of us because we have been there in the past. And the potential to become all of these things is also inside of us, waiting to come out, given the right circumstance and conditions. We have been Muslims in the past. We have been Christians in the past. Men, women, rich, poor, stupid, intelligent, high social status, low social status, atheists, agnostics, everything. Worshippers of Thor and Odin. That's what my ancestors were. They were worshippers of Thor and Odin. Yeah. So we probably all worship Thor and Odin at one stage. It's hard to relate to. We probably have. And what this does, it takes away this feeling of separateness between us. Because we always feel so separate. We divide ourselves up into nationalities, into religion. I'm this one, you are that one. And so we are separate somehow. We're not really that separate. We're actually so close to each other. And this is such a beautiful way of looking at the world because it takes away these barriers between us. And I know that right now here in Sri Lanka, you're going through a very difficult period after the terrorist attacks. So be very careful how you react to these kind of attacks. It's so easy to get angry and upset. And if you do get a bit angry and upset, it's natural, so don't worry too much about it. But try not to fuel the fire by making it worse. Try to reflect in such a way that enables you to instead calm the flames down and make yourself understand instead and accept, tolerate, and eventually also forgive. And this is one of the ways of doing this, by understanding that there is no inherent difference between us. Yeah, we're just moving around, always changing, always becoming different. We have all been Muslims in the past, probably all will be Muslims in the future. Those people who are Muslims now, and even the terrorists, have probably been Buddhists in the past. And once you see that, you just see the human heart, the human mind moving around, depending on causes and conditions. Whatever works on us, that's how we become. To give you an idea how this works, there's a simile that I usually use, a simile of the ship on the ocean. The problem with this ship is that it has no propulsion, it has no steering mechanism, no rudder, no sails, no oars, nothing like that. It's just a hull, an empty hull with nothing more than the hull. Because it has no steering mechanism, because it has no propulsion, the movement of this hull depends entirely on external phenomena. If the wind comes from the south, the hull is going to go to the north. Wind comes from the east, the hull is going to go to the west. If the currents of the water come from the west, it's going to go to the east. So all of these phenomena working on the hull together, and the sum of those phenomena will decide the direction in which that hull moves. Yeah? So if you're going to become a fundamentalist of some kind, and if you come into that fundamentalist wind from the south, you're going to move towards fundamentalism in the north. But if you come into the Buddhist wind instead, which comes from the east, the Buddhist always comes from the east, right? Buddhism comes from the east, and now it's moving to the west, so it moves it to the west. Yeah? And then you become a Buddhist instead. It depends entirely on those external conditions and circumstances, what you become. This is what we are as human beings. And this is one of the reasons why it is so important that we choose our conditioning very carefully. This is why the idea of Kalyanamitta is so important. This is why the idea of who we choose in our life as our conditioning factors, what Dhamma we listen to, all of these things matter so enormously because we are ultimately entirely conditioned. So when you think about it like that, as being a hull on the ocean, this is the idea of no self. No self is no steering mechanism, nothing permanent inside of you that always guides you in the right direction, but being subject to all this external phenomena. And then once you start to think of life like that and think of beings like that, you start to have compassion because you start to understand that we are all trapped by our conditioning, trapped by these external forces, also forces that existed in our past lives, etc., etc. We are trapped in that. We are trapped in our own personalities because our personalities are the sum total of the forces that have worked on us in this life and also in past lives. And once you start to understand this, you can start to feel sorry for some of these people who do terrible acts. Terrorism is terrible. It is really terrible because what it does, it traumatizes whole societies and causes so much trouble and so many bad things. But even though it is such a terrible act, we start to understand where it comes from. And these poor people who do these acts, in the ultimate sense, they are poor because they have been conditioned in such a way they have no choice but to do these kind of suicide bombings or whatever it is. Once you start to see that, you start to feel a bit of sorry for them. You start to feel a bit of compassion because you know they are working out this conditioning inside of them without really having much choice. They are trapped pretty much to do what they are doing. Then you can have compassion because you know it's going to lead to enormous suffering for these people, the way they have been living these things out. So this is one way of thinking about this. Even make it even more clear what I'm talking about. Another way to think about this is one of the similes that I often use, the traffic light simile. You know the traffic light simile? Traffic light simile is you are in a rush. You're going to a meeting or something, doing something important, like coming here to listen to this talk. Is that right? Maybe. Okay, I'm messing around a bit. My teacher is Ajahn Brahm, so if I mess around a bit, he has conditioned me in this way, so send him a letter and tell him off for having a disciple who is kind of doing similar kind of things. So you're on your way to something very urgent, an important meeting, somewhere, and millions of dollars are at play or something like that, I don't know, whatever. Just come around the corner, and just as you come around the corner, the traffic light goes red, and you have to wait for 2 or 3 or 4 minutes or whatever it is. And you have a choice. Either you can get really, really angry with that traffic light. Get out of your car. Give the traffic light a good shake. You evil traffic light. You knew I was coming around the corner and you got red just now because you knew I was in a hurry. You can do that. And then you can get locked up in an asylum afterwards. That is one opportunity. Or you have common sense and you realize, actually, traffic lights, they just work according to a program. And because they work according to a program, it doesn't make much sense to get angry with a traffic light. So you get a bit frustrated, but that's all. You don't really go beyond that. You don't kind of put yourself in kind of make yourself look really stupid by giving that traffic light a good shake or whatever. So, and this is the trick, The idea is that people are ultimately a bit like traffic lights. Sometimes people go red, sometimes they go green, sometimes they are yellow. And how can you, if you're not going to get angry with a traffic light, how can you get angry with people? Same kind of thing. So this is the right way of thinking. This is a use of the idea of anatta or anatman, as I think you say in Sinhala, using this in a way that actually is directly applicable in our lives. It is right view, but using it in a way that actually works. And when you do that, you will find that your lives, your professional life, your family life, whatever else it is that you do, becomes so much easier, because it's so much easier to forgive and let go of things. Because whenever someone is doing something bad towards you, you just remember, traffic light, traffic light. Called the traffic light mantra. There's many mantras. This is the traffic light mantra to be used every day in various circumstances. So this is one aspect of how to use the idea of right view. I want to now to change gear a little bit and to have a look at some of the other aspects. And these other aspects, these are some of my favorite similes from the suttas. And to show you also the idea of how to relate to the world outside of us. And again, it is true for our life in general, certainly true for our professional life, but in a sense, true in a much broader sense for how we're supposed to live. And one of these is the simile that we just had a meditation retreat, and I have taught all of these things already on that retreat, but it doesn't matter. I've taught these similes for so many times, I can't even count them, but it doesn't matter. This is a simile which is a simile of the piece of meat. And according to the simile, there is a bird, and this bird gets hold of the piece of meat, and then it flies off. But a piece of meat is a very valuable thing if you are a bird. It's very difficult for a bird to get hold of a piece of meat. Usually they have to, be happy with worms and insects and that kind of thing. So as soon as this bird gets this piece of meat, other birds, they see it and say, hey, look at this bird, it's got a piece of meat, and they all fly after it, trying to rip that piece of meat out of its claws or out of its beak or whatever else it is. And of course, that other bird, if it doesn't let go of that piece of meat very quickly, it's going to be problematic. It might die, it might, you know, get ripped apart, or who knows what else is going to happen to it. And this simile is a simile for how the world works. The world works always, but we are competing for things in the world, competing for the resources in the world, competing for almost everything in the world, competing for promotion in our jobs, competing for partners, competing for the pleasures in the world, competing at work, yeah, all of these competitions. So the problem of the world is that it has this idea, because we're always competing, because there are limited resources in this world. The pie is only so large, so your slice is only going to be so big. Yeah, because of that, we fight over that pie, we fight over those slices, we fight over the things in this world. And this is really problematic. I talk to people who are, you know, who work, and they always tell me how difficult it can be to be at work, how there's so much office politics and so much backbiting and so many problems. Do you have that here in Sri Lanka as well? Yeah, sometimes, yeah. It's probably everywhere, because the world is it's so globalized now. We kind of export our bad habits across the borders, yeah? So it kind of goes around the world. And this comes from a lot because of this competition driven within our society here. And I think sometimes it is kind of capitalism gone too far. The idea of capitalism, of course, one of the most important aspects of that is the idea of competition. And competition, I think, to some extent is okay here. But sometimes if you take competition too far, it starts to destroy the harmony in society here. If you're going to have a company or a family that works well, if you have too much competition within the family or within the company, it is very hard to have harmony within that system or within that institution. And harmony is so important for progress, for feeling good, for being able to feel relaxed, and for being able to enjoy our lives. If you see what the Buddha had to say about harmony, it is quite fascinating. In the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which is the sutta which talks about the Buddha's last travels when he walked from Rajagaha all the way to Kushinara, where he passed away. Yeah, very interesting sutta, by the way. And I recommend you to have a look at that sutta if you have a chance. In that sutta, he talks about all the things that are necessary for preserving Buddhism in the future. And one of those sutta, one of those little passages, it's a passage of seven things that are required for Buddhism to grow in the future, not to decline. Seven things only, yeah, that are required for Buddhism to succeed in the future. One of those seven things is for the Sangha to be in harmony. So basically what the Buddha is saying here is that for prosperity in the world, for prosperity in the family or whatever it is, harmony is one of the crucial things that we have to strive towards. So this is so important, and I sometimes think that our societies have gone way too far in this idea of competition against each other. We compete at work, we compete everywhere, and because we compete everywhere, we actually reduce the feeling of harmony and our ability to cooperate. Cooperation is so much more beautiful among human beings than always competing and always being at each other's throats, always trying to kind of get the better of the other person. This is so unpleasant in the long run. So we need to really, I think, encourage more harmony in our society, more cooperation, more working together, rather than always driving each other apart in this way. And there's many ways of doing that. But one of the main ways is not to focus too much on things in the wrong way. Focus only on results. Focus only on theory of capitalism that tells you all kind of competition is good. But sometimes we need to step back a little bit and ask ourselves, well, what are we going to place most confidence in? These kind of economic theories? Or are we going to find some confidence in the Buddha's teaching? If the Buddha says harmony is important, perhaps we should consider that, to actually make it work out. And there's many ways we can do this, to have more harmony even in our companies, even in our professional life. For example, we can tie the the remuneration that we have to many different things that actually promote harmony, instead of it being something very individualistic. Your personal performance gets evaluated, and then you have a salary according to that. But no, instead we should have a performance review that has to do with our own conduct, with the conduct of our unit in the company, with the company as a whole perhaps. And if you really want to think big, maybe even as the nation as a whole, yeah? And your salary or your whatever it is, your remuneration or whatever type it is, it should maybe be tied to this broader picture rather than to a narrow performance review that only has to do with you. And then we start to cooperate because our own well-being is tied also to the well-being of the larger group. And then you start to cooperate, work better together, and I think we get a much more pleasant, happy lives, less stressful lives when we work in this way, rather than working always with competition. I know Ajahn Brahm was one of those people who suggested a long time ago that in schools, for example, instead of your grades being solely dependent on your own performance, the grades should also be dependent on what everyone else in the class gets. And the idea is, if the whole class does really well, then you do well. And if the whole class does badly, you do badly. At least part of the grade should be what the class does. And what that means is that we have an interest in helping our co-students. If you have someone in the class who's kind of hanging back a little bit, not doing so well, we say, okay, I'll help you out, yeah? And I'll give you a hand with this. As long as you can't get angry with them, right? You have to kind of gently kind of point them in the right direction or whatever. That's kind of the idea. So maybe it works, maybe it doesn't, I'm not sure. But anyway, that's the idea behind that. It's a beautiful idea, the idea of working together instead of always competing in this way. So this is the idea of the piece of meat. It's the danger that this world is inherently problematic because we tend to fight, compete over the limited resource in this world. And because that is inherent to our society is, at the same time harmony is important, we have to try to find ways of having more harmony in this world. So this is the first simile that I just to give you an idea of how to think from a Buddhist point of view. And this has to do with right view, because it has to do with what we value in the world, what actually is important. Right view in practice rather than right view in theory. Another of these beautiful similes of the Buddha is a simile of the fruits on a tree, it is called. And according to this simile, there is a person who has an axe, and they walk into a dense forest grove. A dense forest grove is like the human existence. Yeah, when we wander around in our life and we do all kinds of things, we enjoy ourselves here, we enjoy ourselves there, we have a job, and we're wandering around in the sensory existence, seeing things, hearing things, smelling, tasting things. This is what our whole life is like. We are immersed in sensory existence. This is called kama loka in the suttas, kama avachara actually, but anyway, it doesn't matter. Kama loka, the world of sensory experience. And so it goes into this jungle. And when you go into this jungle of sensory experience, you're always looking for happy sensory outcomes. You want to enjoy the sensory life. You want to enjoy nice food, nice entertainment. You want to enjoy having a nice partner in this life. You want to enjoy having a good reputation. Yeah, all of these things. So you wander around in this forest, looking around for all the good things. Yeah, searching, craving, desiring all the good things in the world. And then you come to this tree, tree with beautiful fruit on it, fruit that is just ripe, maybe mangoes. I always found that most people like mangoes. Is anyone here who doesn't like mangoes? I'm always trying to find someone who doesn't like mangoes. It's really difficult. Is there someone hiding somewhere who doesn't like mangoes? So, because most people like mangoes, mangoes are kind of a suitable thing, especially when the mango is just right, yeah, just firm enough, nice and sweet and all of that. So this is one of those trees where the mango is just right. So he looks up, and this is like finding some grand, sensual, sensory thing in this world, something very beautiful. So he thinks, well, I've found this tree, let me climb up into this tree, yeah, go up, eat these mangoes, and then have a bag, and then fill my bag, and then come down again afterwards. And of course, when you climb one of these mango trees, when you start eating those mangoes, when you indulge in sensory things, which is often what the sensory realm and human existence is about, you lose your mindfulness. by definition, this is what lack of mindfulness means. Indulgent in sensory pleasures means you are completely consumed with what you're doing and you lack the ability to stand back and see what is going on clearly. You have no mindfulness anymore. You are engrossed in that sensory experience. And when you lose your mindfulness, you lose your ability to regulate your life properly so as to choose things that are good and avoid things that are bad. This is what mindfulness is about. It's about having the ability to regulate our lives in a good way. We don't get caught up in powerful emotions that drive us in the wrong way. And when you don't regulate your mind in the right way, you end up doing many silly things. A large part of the being intoxicated by anything in this world is that when you are intoxicated, whether it's by alcohol or drugs or sensual pleasures, yeah, this is what the Buddha is saying here, there are so many things that can intoxicate us. When you do that, you start doing stupid things, and that is the problem. So then the simile continues. Then another man comes along. He's also carrying an axe on his shoulder and a bag, looking for fruit trees. This is samsara, looking for something nice in samsara. He comes to the same tree here. He looks up, he says, wow, all those beautiful fruit. I don't know how to climb a tree, so I better take my axe and cut down the tree at the bottom. So what's going to happen with the fellow in the top? He's not going to be too, if he doesn't gain his mindfulness back, if he doesn't start to listen to what is going on, if he doesn't understand that the tree is about to fall over, he might die, or at least break something, break his arm or something like that when he falls down. And this is the problem of samsara. If you are heedless, if you don't look at things in the appropriate way, if you don't think about life in the appropriate way, then suddenly things overcome you, and suddenly one day, bang, death comes or something comes, and then you have to suffer the consequences of your lack of mindfulness. You've been caught up in the sensory world without really understanding the bigger picture. Suddenly you die, and then you have done many silly things because of your lack of mindfulness in the process. And this is how this life of ours works sometimes. Yeah, we forget what really matters in the world. And because we forget what matters in the world, we end up doing really, really bad things like this. So what does this mean in practice? And what it means in practice is that we have to remind ourselves of what is actually important in this life, what we should focus on. And very often, one of the things that I like to say to people is that instead of focusing on the results so much, we should focus more on the processes of life. If you focus on the results, it means that we're always looking at the bottom line in the company, on how we're going to compete with the other companies, if we're going to win that contract or not, all of those things. And we put everything into that. And when you put everything into the results, and the results are all that matter, it means sometimes you will take shortcut to achieve those results. And the reason is because the craving and the desire to achieve the results is so strong that you are like that man in the, or maybe woman or whoever it is, up in that tree eating mangoes. You lose your mindfulness because your craving is so strong to achieve results within your company or family, whatever it is, that you start not practicing morality anymore. The morality goes out the window because the craving takes over. You have to achieve those results. And this is why people sometimes who are professionals, they end up doing bad things for the results of the company or the results of the family or whatever it is. They do bad things because the craving to get there is so strong. And it reminds, there's so many stories you may hear all the time about people making precisely those errors, yeah? And I remember it was one story. This was a famous investment banker on Wall Street. This was back in the 1980s. The reason I can remember this is because it was before I ordained. Anything else between is kind of a bit of a blur, but this I can kind of remember. It's actually, no, I know a little bit about the world, even though I'm a monk, but this is what kind of one of those first experiences that really opened my eyes to the problem of greed. And this was a very famous investment banker. His name was Ivan Boesky. And he was one of those people who went around on the American university campuses and he said to people on the campus that greed is good. This is exactly the opposite of the Buddha's teaching, yeah? The Buddha said greed is bad. This man says greed is good, wandering around on these campuses. And the reason why he says greed is good, because greed gives some effort, makes people make an effort, and so it's good for the economy. Yeah. So because it's good for the economy, greed must be good, and therefore it will kind of boost the national economic output or whatever it is, and then it's, everything is really nice. So he wandered around saying this, and he obviously believed it. And then in the US they have these lists of the wealthiest people, these really silly lists, as if wealth is all that important, but these long lists, yeah? So you have like these magazines called Fortune, whatever it is, and then you have, you know, the richest man in the world, and then goes down to number 500 or something. And this is 1 year, he was number 500, yeah, on this list. So you've always done really, really well for yourself to be the 500th richest person in the world. It's pretty astonishing. But he was not satisfied, he was too greedy. So he said to his wife, he said, "This is the last time you see me at the bottom of that list." And then what happened? Because he was overcome by greed, overcome by all the stupidity, he started doing dodgy dealings, insider trading and all kind of stuff. And before you know it, he was in prison. And then he was obviously, his entire project that was based on greed was completely destroyed as a consequence. And this is what greed does. This is what lack of perspective on life does. It makes you do stupid things as a consequence. So for that reason, it is so important in life that instead of focusing so much on the results, because we don't know the results anyway. And this fellow, Ivan Boesky, is a classic example. He was absolutely focused on the result of becoming super wealthy, and he failed miserably because he brought himself down through his actions. So we often cannot make outcomes happen. Results are always going to be uncertain. You can try really hard to get this girlfriend or boyfriend or husband or wife in your life. Sometimes it's not going to work out. You may work really hard at work and somebody else gets the promotion. We just don't know about the results. So instead of focusing on the results, we start to focus on the process. We ask ourselves, how do I get these results? How do I live my life? What are the qualities of mind that are put into the process that leads up to these results? And the qualities of mind and heart that you put into these things, that is what we call karma, that is kindness, that is compassion, that is generosity, understanding, wisdom, all of these positive things. If you put that into the process, you're doing something with your personality. You're gaining some spiritual qualities inside of yourself. You're actually becoming a better and more happy person as a consequence. And then, if the result comes, okay, wonderful if the result comes. But if the result doesn't come, you have built up a store of goodness inside of yourself. It doesn't matter so much if the result doesn't come, because you have something else that actually, in the end, is far more valuable. So this is then the way you start to think. And if you start to think in this way, the Buddha speaks about how to treat, for example, employees. He talks about this in the Sigalovada Sutta that you may have heard of, sometimes called the Sutta on Lay Ethics. And this is the sutta which talks about the ethics for lay people in great detail. And it talks also about how to look after your employees. And it says in there that we look after our employees by looking after them when they're sick, to give them work according to their ability. Yeah, sometimes we demand too much of people. We think that you should work harder. But sometimes we forget that people don't have the ability maybe to work harder. They are conditioned to do what they can, what they are doing. Anyway, so we look after them in this way. We look after them with health care. We give them the appropriate salary. We give them a bonus or whatever when that is required. And all of those things are in there. So this is what we think. We think about things in a different way. We look after people. We have compassion and care. This becomes the broader outlook, rather than being too concerned about the bottom line, profit maximization. And what is interesting, and I don't know about your experience, but in my experience, it is often those companies that care for their employees, the companies that actually have a sense of social responsibility in the world, very often they are the ones that are the most successful. The people who I know who have been very successful in professional life are people who are like inherently very good people, who really care for others, but they also have intelligence, they also have drive at the same time. And because people trust them and people feel that they're getting supported, those companies are sometimes enormously successful. Whereas if there's too much greed, too much hardness, sometimes it doesn't work out. And anyway, even if it doesn't work out, it doesn't matter, because you have the qualities of heart to carry with you into the future. Another, this is another idea of right view, remembering your priorities, yeah? Remembering the danger of defilements of the mind, the greed, the anger, the delusion, these things that distort the mind and make us do stupid things. Okay, just keeping an eye on the time. One more simile here before I stop. And this is one of my, also one of these beautiful similes that shows you about priorities in life, what actually is important to prioritize. And this is what I call the simile of the borrowed goods. And according to this simile here, there is a man who has borrowed various kinds of goods. In this simile, very simple things. But you can imagine you have borrowed a really fancy car, for example, yeah? A really nice car, whatever it is, a Ferrari perhaps, or whatever it is. Yeah, I'm sure you have some Ferraris here in Colombo as well, and maybe a really nice house, yeah? And then you kind of use this, you drive around in the Ferrari, and people look at your car, yeah? We say, wow, check out that Ferrari. Yeah, when I'm a monk, I still look at the Ferraris when I see the Ferraris. I'm not supposed to, but I still do. I said, oh no, I looked at the Ferrari again. It's not a big issue. But so after a while, you feel, when you drive this Ferrari, you feel really important, yeah, and you feel really, and it goes to your ego, your sense of self, you feel, yeah, I'm a Ferrari owner, yeah. These other people, they only have BMWs, but I have a Ferrari. Because we have, the problem is that if you have borrowed these goods, it doesn't take long before you have to hand them back again. And if you then, in the meantime, you have identified with these things, when you have to give them back again, because you identify with it, actually it's very difficult to give up. Because it almost become part of your personality. I am the Ferrari driver, yeah? I am special because of that. And when you have to give it up again, actually it is very hard. Now the point of this simile is that everything in this life, everything in this world is like borrowed goods. It's like that borrowed Ferrari. Everything in your life is going to only last for a certain time, and then you're going to have to give it up again. All the things that belong to you in this life, some of those things you will lose them while you're still alive, but everything you own is going to have to go at the very latest when you die. Everything is going to have to go. How much do you want to attach to all of those things that are going to have to go? What happens when you die if you're attached to those things? It feels terrible. It feels like, no, this is my things. I want to take them with me. And, you know, it's funny when people say that, but actually this is what we have tried to do throughout human history. If you look at human history and you look at the burials of people who were wealthy or whatever, they would always put all their things into the grave. Why? So they could take them with them into the next life. Yeah, you know that. This happens everywhere around the world. I happen to come from Norway, and if you dig out the ancient graves of the Vikings, the Viking ship was there in the grave, all their belongings, all the jewelry. Sometimes their wives would be put in there as well. Very, very cruel. But not only in Norway, this happens around the world. It happened in China, for example, exactly the same idea. And around many cultures in the world, this was a tradition because you wanted to take these things with you into the future. You are so attached to your things that you think that if I put it all in my grave, then maybe somehow I can smuggle them on to the next life. But you can't do that. You can't, you know, it's absurd. It doesn't work like that. And all that is lost is all this all this wealth is kind of lost into this grave. Doesn't really work out. So this means that being too attached to our worldly possession is going to be really problematic when eventually you die. It is not just our worldly possessions, it's also our relationships with people around us, everyone in this world that we are close to, all our family members, all our friends, all our acquaintances, all the people who we love the most in this world are going to have to go. It's a little bit heartbreaking, but we know it is the truth. It obviously is the truth. Not just that, but so much of our personality, so much of the psychological things that we own, that we have identified, they too belong to this world. Our social position is about how we relate to other people in this world. Our education is about what we have done in this world previously in terms of university. Who we are in the family, what kind of position we have there, what kind of... all of these things also relate to this world. When you die, all that too is really going to have to go. What is not much left after a while. It's like you're emptying out all these things. And of course, the last thing that's going to have to go is your physical body. So this is the simile of the borrowed goods. All of these things that we spend so much time on are borrowed goods. It's all going to have to be handed back. So how much effort are you going to put in to these borrowed goods? Are you going to spend your entire life building up these worldly things? And then when you come to your deathbed, you say, what now? I'm going to have to give it all up again. How do you feel? You feel terrible. You feel like you have wasted your time. You feel confused. You wonder, what on earth was this life all about anyway? I've just wasted so much time doing these things. Now it's all going to have to be given back. You can see how empty you would feel and how terrible you would feel on your deathbed if that is how you live. But usually it's much worse than that, because if achieving all of these things in your life is so important to you, if that is what matters, if the results of these things are what matters to you, often you also take shortcuts in your morality. You cheat a little bit, you lie a little bit, you do some dodgy deals, yes? Because this is so important to you that you're willing to compromise your morality at the same time. So not only can you not take anything with you when you die, but you have compromised your morality, so you feel bad about yourself at the same time. Double whammy, double negative. No wonder many people, when they die, they can't let go. They can't just move on into the future, because their present situation is so difficult to deal with that they cannot try desperately to cling on, because they understand they have lived badly and lived stupidly. So please don't make that mistake. Please don't make the mistake of just living for this world. Instead, take a long-term view of things. This is why this is a long-term investment we're talking about here. And this is why the idea of rebirth is so important. One of the many reasons, but one extremely important reason why it matters so enormously, because it opens up your investment horizon. Instead of thinking only about this narrow little slice of time, which is our life, it is so short in the bigger picture. We open up to this much vaster possibility of rebirth in the future, and we actually start to invest for the long term. When the Buddha says you are the owner of your karma, that is what he means. The karma is the mind that we create in this life and we carry with us into the future. Everything in this world is borrowed. The only thing you own is your karma. That is what you take with you into the future. So what is that karma? And that karma is really the qualities you have in your heart. It is your kindness, your generosity, your wisdom, your understanding, all of these qualities. That is the karma. It is the brightness of the mind, the purity you have inside. Lift that up in this life. Build it up to the maximum. So you have the maximum good qualities. Then, when you die, you will know that you have lived well. It will be easier for you to give up all of the things in the world, because you have something very beautiful inside of you that you can take with you into the future lives. This is called long-term investment. If you want to do long-term investment, don't go down to the local bank and ask them for investment advice. Don't go to some of these fancy investment banks that you find sometimes. Come instead to the Buddha. The Buddha will tell you how to do long-term investment. Everything else is Mickey Mouse investment. Don't do Mickey Mouse investment. Yeah, do, what is the right kind? Anyway, it doesn't matter. Do Buddha investment. Yeah, think of it. This is a new kind of concept, Buddha investment. I just thought of it. I think there's a good chance for a good brand name there, Buddha investment. It's about selling the Dhamma. This is the thing when you are a monk, you have to sell the Dhamma. You are kind of a PR agent. Yeah, so Buddha investment. I'll write that down, Venerables. Thank you. So, but this is so important. If, you know, these things are extremely important because it changes your entire outlook and the way how you live your life. And again, it comes back to this idea I just mentioned before, that instead of living for the results in this life, you focus so much more on the process instead. Because the processes in this life, that is where you build up your good heart and your kindness. You ask yourself, how do I achieve things in my life? What is the process I use to get them? Am I using kindness? Am I using morality? Am I using all of these good qualities inside of me? And if I am, then I'm using the process in the right way. If I'm not, then I'm not taking the opportunity to use this process in a good way. And this is how you change your outlook. You change the way you live. You start to live with more kindness, with more care, more compassion, more understanding for your fellow human beings. And then you are living for long-term investment rather than short-term investment. So please take some of these ideas into your life. And not only will it be good for the long-term investment, it will also be very useful for this very life. You feel better in this life, and it also will be for the long-term good and benefit. So that is all I want to say, I think. I want to leave a little bit of opportunity for some questions, if you have some questions, because I can talk a lot, but it may turn out to be completely irrelevant for you. So it's nice for you to have a chance to ask some questions. So can we please move on to stage B or whatever?